Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th of June, Monday at 9. It's all things political, and we have a lot of things to talk about. I thought we would start with a meeting in Unity, New Hampshire, where the place was picked for the meeting between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, because this is pretty amazing, isn't it? The dead even results in the primary. Clinton, 107 votes. Obama, 107 votes. Someone in New Hampshire brought the town to the attention of Obama's campaign manager, and then they decided this would be the place for the unity event. We will talk about that and who came under the scorching sun and whether or not they believe in unity now. We also have a number of other issues to talk about today on our All Things Political. We'll look at whether or not Obama is moving to the center and why that may be the case. There's a lot of news about what might be happening in Iran, how that will play into the general election. What about the changing electoral map? News over the weekend has shown that if Obama could pick up three western states that went Republican in 2004, plus got all the states that Kerry received in 2004, he could win the election. Is that likely or is it not likely? What about offshore oil drilling? And really, what about the economy? Again, the news over the weekend, polling showing that 9 out of 10 Americans say this economy is poor or fair. 73% of Americans driving less, 68% eating out less and seeing fewer movies, just not doing what they do for entertainment anymore, staying more at home because of the economy and the high price of fuel. What does all of that mean for this election? We have two guests with us this hour, and of course, we'll welcome you to our conversation. Professor David Jackson is with us. Professor Jackson is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. He has special interest in the relationship between entertainment and politics, specifically examining connections between media use habits and political beliefs among the English-speaking young adult populations of the United States and Canada. He's the author of Entertainment and Politics, the influence of pop culture in young adult political socialization, and he teaches courses on U.S. politics, research methods, American political thought, politics and mass media, and also Canadian government. Professor David Jackson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us today. Oh, you're on this line.
That's such a great introduction.
Well, you must have a great life, right? Everything I said was true. Also joining us is Professor Burdette Bird Loomis, who's a professor in the Department of Political Science, and he is at the University of Kansas and did his undergraduate work. Oh, not undergraduate. He did his advanced work at the University of Wisconsin Political Science and his PhD in Political Science from the University of Wisconsin. And he is interested in American politics, Congress, interest groups, and state legislatures, and was a visiting scholar at the Brookings Institution and director of administrative communications for Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who has been mentioned as a possible VP. Oh, I forgot. We got to add that to the list, too, potential vice presidential candidates. And welcome to you, Professor Loomis. Hi.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have both of you with us. Well, let's talk about this unity event, which took place last week. I did think it was amazing. I know this is a simple thing off the track, but the blue tie and the blue pantsuit just about matched. I guess it wasn't really planned, but it topped it off, didn't it, gentlemen?
Well, they say it wasn't planned, but it sure looked good. It's also good to have the honorary Republican mayor of the town saying he's going to switch and support the Democrats, or might do so. I mean, they couldn't have put together a better event in terms of symbolism and what was, you know, put forth for people to see.
Right. Does he really need her to actively campaign? I know there were some women in the audience who admitted to heavy hearts about the outcome and were carrying Hillary signs here as well. Are the women who voted for Clinton and felt so passionately about her going to move to him, or is there a doubt that that might happen?
Yeah, I think that the general notion is that, yes, they would move to her, but I think it's crucial that she actively and enthusiastically campaign for him. I think that there really is an issue around, you know, you can name your number, 20-25% of her supporters, but I think her enthusiastic support, her discussion of how her policies and his line up, a whole variety of things will work to his advantage if she is enthusiastic. And it looks like out of the gate here that she is.
Mm-hmm. And it must be a hard thing for her to do, don't you think, Professor Loomis, after all those months, all that campaigning to lose, and really by a very close margin. She must have been pretty unhappy for a few weeks, don't you think?
For one night, she was very unhappy, and I think there's some question whether Bill is still unhappy.
Yeah.
But honestly, you know, she is a professional politician of the first order, and it's not as if she learned she was going to lose suddenly one evening. That had been coming for some months.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that, that there had been a transition. But no question that it's hard. I think it may be harder for some of those supporters, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. And Professor Jackson, what about Bill Clinton? Is there a great deal of animosity? What's the reason for that? Do you expect him to campaign? Should he campaign?
Well, the Clinton operation, Terry McAuliffe and those folks are swearing up and down that there's no animosity, that, you know, Bill Clinton gets, you know, very angry very quickly, stays angry for about a day, and then moves on.
Mm.
And I think that that's sort of the general consensus about his personality. So, yeah, I guess he's probably pretty upset, but at some point there'll be a meeting, some sort of probably public event between Obama and Bill Clinton along the same lines. But, I mean, it makes sense that the actual candidate had to do the public event with Senator Obama first. And as you know, Bill Clinton has said, she's the political, you know, head of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Right now. So for him to have, you know, put himself again front and center would have been a bad choice. So if he's, you know, stewing a little bit, that's fine.
Right.
He'll probably get over it, and then there'll be another, you know, sort of symbolic event that captures some headlines. So I think that, you know, he may be very upset, but this is to be expected, right? She came so close, and
mm-hmm.
that's got to be so painful.
Yeah.
You just don't get that many chances.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. How would you both answer the question, is Obama, I think he is, and I'm wondering why he's doing that, moving to the center on some issues, the death penalty, certainly the gun issue, which he's kind of changed his mind on. Why is he doing this? What's going on with the campaign? Do Democrats still believe you have to move to the center to win?
I think this is an election that will be won in the center. I think that's the conventional wisdom. That's how McCain, the only way McCain can win the election is in the center. And certainly I think the Obama camp sees that as well. And once saying that, I really think that David Brooks' column about a week ago got it right. There is this two Obamas. There's the idealist, and then there is the Chicago Paul.
Yeah.
And I think he wants to win. And you begin to see in the blogosphere some hand wringing here. But I think the political science conventional wisdom is even though some of these steps may be a little painful, he's doing what he needs to do.
Well, and let's not forget there were something like 36 million votes between Hillary and Barack, but in the general election there'll probably be 110 million, so there's 60 or 70 million people who haven't really met this candidate yet, and so he has to spend this time introducing himself to what will be the majority of the electorate. And that's fairly conventional wisdom, I think, that each political party in their primaries have, you know, the candidates run to the extremes of their spectrum, and then back to the middle for the general election.
Right. And what about McCain? There have been a lot of reports recently that he hasn't worked a full weekend he hasn't worked any days of the weekend for months, maybe just one day some months ago. Does he need to campaign a little bit harder?
Well, it might not be a bad choice for him to have spent some time sort of recharging the batteries and getting ready. He did some efforts, again, to sort of introduce himself, to sort of, you know, set the narrative of who he is and where he comes from. I don't think it would make a heck of a lot of sense for him to be, you know, really working really, really, really hard right now, because, you know, this isn't the time when traditionally that much attention is being paid by the full electorate to the campaign. So I think in his case, and probably most candidates' case, it's good to recharge before, you know, going full steam ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're also dealing with a guy who's going to be 72
sure.
at the general election, and has a tremendous, there's a real difference here between Obama and McCain. Perhaps the age difference is as crucial as anything in this, and if he cannot, through the course of a very difficult campaign, a long one, be relatively strong. And he has shown indications that when he's tired, he really looks bad and doesn't perform very well.
Mm-hmm.
So he may well need to have be in this for the marathon and not for the sprint.
Hmm. Professor Jackson, do you think age will be a big issue in this campaign?
I think it will. I think
really?
The Obama campaign has to be very careful how it plays it. They'll use, code words. They will never say, he's too old, but they'll refer to comments as, baffling or incoherent,
mm-hmm.
All sort of implying something about his age.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that just the physicality here, you may not even have to say anything.
Right.
You had Obama playing basketball,
right.
And McCain not being able to raise his arm above his shoulder.
Right, right. And yet he is thought of, and rightfully so, by many people as a war hero. So doesn't that help him? He took a... He took a lot of abuse.
Well, General Clark sure took a didn't he? Saying that that's not necessarily a qualification for being president. Now, I don't know if that was a tryout by General Clark for the vice presidential attack dog nomination or where that was coming from, but it certainly was, Rovian, I would say, in the sense that it definitely went against the strength of the opponent.
Yeah. Did you read that story? I thought it was funny that Obama was going in with his whole entourage to play basketball in some Washington gym yesterday, and then the woman at the desk, he just sort of walked by and said, "Where is your ID? Where is your ID?" And he came back, and she realized it. Then she looked at him and realized who he was and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr." She thought he was going to be the next president, Mr. Future President. But
Well, we folks who follow this thing, find that sort of amazing, but, not everybody follows politics as closely as we do.
What about this idea that both of you have suggested? It seems to me as though everybody knows who John McCain is, that we know his war story, or I think we do, and yet we don't really know all that much about Obama. Are we more likely then to go for the known, the comfortable, the war hero? And does it indicate that Obama has a heck of a lot of work to do to introduce himself to the American public?
David?
Well, I think that's part of the reason why he stepped out of the public financing system, so that he would have the money to introduce himself that way. I think the evidence, suggests that this is a change election, and Barack Obama is obviously the candidate of change. The sale still has to be made, though, right? In terms of convincing people that these. Times that you mentioned economically in the introduction demand a candidate that, frankly, is unique in the history of major presidential nominees in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I do think that
certainly among some voters to prefer something tried and true and safe, but everything else indicates that people want some significant changes made, and so this is the Democrats' election to lose. I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Yeah, no, I think your setup was exactly right, that as days go on, the Republican strategists, particularly in the House and Senate right now, just see no way to campaign. Everyone's in their lifeboat in the House and Senate. And the presidency is a little different. McCain's certainly the strongest Republican candidate, and largely because he has this maverick, veteran kind of exposure. If we get a little more bad, how much more bad news do you need?
Right.
But the idea of Obama and change, even if he is somewhat ill-defined, remains pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little more about the economy, gentlemen, and whether or not either of these candidates has a plan. These statistics really indicate that people are hurting this gas thing. We were listening to reports on NPR this morning of, truck drivers or people who have to drive quite a distance to get to their jobs. And if you're poor, it's like 16% of your salary, if not more than that, to pay for transportation. 73% of Americans driving less. 9 out of 10 saying the economy is poor or fair. Obviously, this is a huge issue in this election. And I don't know if either one of these candidates has a solution to it.
I don't think that in some ways, I don't think the electorate expects a solution. But I do think they would tend to reject what's going on right now, and that really is McCain's strength, that he can say, "I'm not what's going on right now."
Mm-hmm.
So far we haven't seen any great bold plans. I'm not sure we're going to see anything before the before the election, say a huge public works program or something like that. I think you're absolutely right that neither has any kind of a sweeping plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would it be a poor choice for Obama to even make an incredibly sort of grandiose economic plan? There's enough about Obama for a lot of voters that's going to be difficult anyway, and to propose sort of a very radical economic agenda might be just a step too far. I mean, there has been the proposal of $150 billion or so on spending for alternative energy, but that's over 10 years. And so compared to, say, spending that much in a year in Iraq, that's not really a radical proposal. I know some folks are out there saying that the Democrats need to propose a sort of Manhattan Project for alternative energy and make it the great national purpose. But I'm not sure that the Obama campaign wants to, sort of hitch its wagon to one agenda item like that.
Mm-hmm. What is the a lot about him that will be difficult for voters?
Well, I think Ed Rendell in Pennsylvania has said some things that some folks in Pennsylvania would have a difficult time voting for an African-American. I forget what exact percentage it is right now, but I think the polls indicated it was double digits who still believe that Obama is a Muslim. Certainly the Reverend Wright did him no favors.
Right.
There's things that work against him.
Mm-hmm. Let's take as long as we were on age and email, and then we'll pause and go to our telephone callers, which are lining up for you. Al from Milwaukee says, it's not age itself, but capability, which we all know deteriorates with age in most people. Why don't we test candidates for capability, mental health? Many areas give psychological tests to police officers. Why not presidential ones? Tests are given for driver's licenses. Why not for presidents? It would be reassuring to know that candidates have passed some objective tests of their capacity for doing the job.
Well, that's what the campaign is.
Yeah, right.
Right, yeah.
So the libertarian in me just cringes at that notion of a objective test for the presidency, quote unquote objective test.
No, I think that the I mean, you may take it a little lightly, but the campaign tests physical abilities, organizational abilities, a variety of, and I wouldn't say it's a perfect surrogate for running the country by any stretch of the imagination, but it is running in these days a long, complicated, and obviously very expensive enterprise.
Well, mm-hmm. And essentially it's an experimental design, too, because each candidate
right.
has to run their campaign and
right.
essentially the same. So it's a perfect, fair comparison.
Yeah. I've said this so many times on the air, gentlemen. I can't believe anybody can keep up this kind of schedule without collapsing. It is just so brutal.
I ran for a small county office once 15 years ago in Michigan, and that was brutal.
Really?
I mean, there were 15,000 constituents, and mercifully I lost the election, but I don't know how people managed to do this national thing.
I think working for the governor of Kansas for a year, just staggering at how many times that she would, leave an event at 10 or 11 in the evening, and be up at 4 or 5 to get in the car to fly someplace and to do it, day after day, month after month.
Right.
Staggering.
Is she on the short list for vice president, do you think?
Sure, I think she is. I think that I think I've said many times that I don't think she'll get it. I just happened to look at the betting market on candidates today in trade, and she's about 1 in 10, which I think is a fair assessment of her chances. She has no real foreign policy experience. I don't know what she brings. She has a very close relationship with Obama. I think he trusts her a lot. And she's been a good administrator, but 1 in 10 is probably fair.
Mm-hmm. Phone calls for both of you in just one moment. All things political for this Monday. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, a fascinating and extremely alarming story featured on the front cover of the National Geographic for July, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? It's quite a story, and our guest who wrote the piece tried to find out by actually entering the territory at much danger to himself where the gorillas were killed. All right, let's go to phone calls. Professor David Jackson, Associate Professor, Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. Professor Burdette Bird Loomis, Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Kansas. And we start our calls with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Well, the boogeyman con game continues on Iraq. And the con is that if we leave, quote, they will take over. But, of course, they never tell us which they it might be, or do they offer any proof of how this might happen. The fact that the Iraqis resisted our occupation speaks for itself in terms of rejecting any al-Qaeda elements that might want to take over. The Chicago Tribune on Sunday had an article that said the Syrians are afraid of us, and the Iranians are subject to the Mike Tyson syndrome. And what I mean by this is that if you or I or anybody else walked up to Mike Tyson and said he was ugly, we'd be subject to overwhelming shock and awe. And the Iranians have already observed our shock and awe, rendered without putting one boot on the ground. We used bombs and missiles from our ships and our submarines and our air bases to level Iraq. So this being the case, the Iranians know that it would be crazy to try to take over Iraq. And besides, why would they even want to do so, given the fact that they're on pretty good relationships with the Shiites, which now, thanks to our action, the action the Republicans voted for, have put the Shiites in the majority in Iraq. So, you know, where are the complaints? What are they complaining about it when they voted for this in the first place?
Professor Loomis, you want to start?
Hard. There's a lot there, and certainly I'm more of an expert on American politics than I am on Iraqi. But I do think that this is about casting, both candidates casting about for ways to get out. And in many ways, I think McCain is as eager for all his 100 years talk to get out as Obama is. And I'm not sure the policies would be that much different. At some point, you have to have faith that things will work out to a greater or lesser extent. In terms of the analysis, I think that the caller generally has got that political soup right over there. There's a lot of reason to think that you could, in a gradual way, move away from it. But in terms of a political issue, as it plays in this election, I find it very difficult that either candidate will be too definitive, and even Obama is slightly moving away from some of his earlier statements.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. What in the world is going on inside Iran? I mean, is this? Did both of you worry that this could be? There could be some action here. There could be an Israeli strike. There's U.S. intelligence. We understand from Seymour Hersh now that there's a lot going on inside the country. It feels as though things are bubbling up.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about what, you know, the Bush administration might do in its last months with regard to Iran. Again, as an American politics specialist, I'd be, you know, loath to make, you know, too many sort of definitive statements about Middle Eastern politics per se. But it is very difficult to predict exactly what the Bush administration might do, because mm-hmm. to whatever extent the critique is true that there's something of a messianic impulse in the administration to fix as many things as possible in their minds before they leave office, then that would argue in favor of some sort of action. Especially one could argue, and again, this is just based on logic and not necessarily any specific evidence or contacts that I have, right? But if it's perceived by the Bush administration that Obama is on his way to victory and he wouldn't continue the sort of policies they like, one might argue that that would cause the Bush administration to be more more likely to try to set things right the way they would prefer them. So,
I can't say I totally disagree with that analysis. It does take my breath away.
to think that's even
possible. I think within the administration or within the government, as the caller pointed out, the airstrike capability is enough to do the job, but as I understand it, the military by and large and the army is completely against moving anything into Iran. They really are not being able to handle very well Iraq and Afghanistan right now. The idea of stretching it thinner really seems ludicrous. I also think that some of this is a little reminiscent of pre-Iraq days, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. You hear all these things, but sorting them out is extraordinarily difficult.
And if we move on that front, does it not also have the danger of perhaps not helping McCain, considering the fact that the American people are not very happy with what's going on in Iraq?
Well, isn't that why, was it former Ambassador Bolton who suggested that something might happen in Iran between the election and the end of the Bush administration? But the idea of a military strike happening during the lame duck period is, again, you know, to me, almost inconceivable. Mm. But I guess it goes, again, to the fundamental question of to what extent President Bush and certain among his advisors believe that they're the only ones who get it,
right,
and that they have to do something before they leave. Now, I can't answer that question, but I think those, for me, are the terms of analysis.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Glenn from Stevens Point next. Hi, Glenn.
Good morning. My question is, I'd like thoughts from both professors. It's kind of an argument I've been having with my girlfriend. Concern was, a lot of her younger friends and people are first-time voters. I'm really energized by the Obama campaign, and they're coming on board because what they hear is some policy ideas and what that notion of change. And now with this sliding towards the middle, as it's called, I argue it's a good thing in that the fact that there's always going to be this block of voters who Obama is their only choice. They would never consider McCain, and by moving to the center, it kind of helps. Traditionally, I've always said, like, the Democrats have always rather lost the right way than won the wrong way, and I feel like the Republicans have been very good at winning elections regardless of what they're saying or what they're doing and their policy is. And I guess our argument is, or I'd like to find out, is it going to maybe some of those first-time voters or people involved in political process kind of, are they going to phase out and say, wait a minute, this is not the big change I thought.
Mm-hmm.
This is just redressing. And this is the same old mainstream Democratic idea.
Yeah, it's a good question.
It's an open question, and it's a good one. And I think that the Democrats, you know, you can go broke counting on younger voters to save your bacon. That said, on the ground in a red state like Kansas, albeit in a little blue dot of a county in the middle of a red state, I really see the Obama enthusiasm continuing in terms of grassroots kind of organizing, the excitement of younger people. So fingers crossed for the Obama people. I think that that does continue, and I think that there's some question of going to the middle, but I don't think that they're quite that worried or sophisticated. I think that he represents, and David might speak to this more, the first 21st century candidate, someone who is, you know, in some ways, you know, post-race. We can talk about that. But I think that the enthusiasm isn't just on political position. It's on this persona.
Well, let's look at, too, what happened in 2004 with the whole Dean phenomenon, right? Young people were very motivated, very supportive of him. There was a shred of the similar, what, you know, critics would say, cult of personality around him. And then what happened in the general election? Well, a lot of the analysis, I think, was incorrect that said that, you know, young people failed to turn out. They turned out in the same proportion of the electorate as before, but everybody's turnout went up. So they did turn out in increased numbers. It's just they didn't swing the election. So they didn't all evaporate, even after losing their candidate to John Kerry. In terms of the sort of way in which this, you know, Obama phenomenon is, you know, truly something new. Yeah, a lot of the support that I think a lot of young people have for Obama has as much to do with, you know, who he is and what he represents as it has to do with any specific policy positions, because frankly, that's not, you know, the core of what he ran on in the primaries by making, you know, specific arguments. So I don't think a lot of young people are going to evaporate in terms of their support for Obama because of this idea that he's moving toward the middle. On the other hand, if he loses, then there will be a huge amount of disappointment, but I would encourage young people. I mean, I, you know, have been active in politics myself, and the first candidate I ever worked for president got 40% of the vote. So you can, you know, guess, you know, who that was. And the point is, you come back, you know, for more. Hopefully, there's a certain, you know, encouragement that, you know, older voters would hopefully give to younger voters of, well, this is a maturing process and we don't always win. And there's no way to say that without sounding as condescending as I just did, but mm-hmm. it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let's talk about this. I think you brought this up, Professor Loomis, that in some ways he is post-race. What do you mean by that?
Well, I really do think that if you look at the polling data that I've seen, is that if you get under 35 years old, there's really not much issue of race. And I do think, I mean, just from a neighborhood gathering 2 days ago, a potluck dinner, and in a pretty white neighborhood, or I thought, but I walked a couple blocks, and there was a bunch of kids going into elementary school and junior high, kind of a racially mixed group zipping around, and it was just I got this sense that this gathering, and many university towns would represent this, race really wasn't an issue among these folks. And I do think it breaks down in generational grounds. You hear some of these interviews with people in their 60s, 70s. Former attorney general from Kansas was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he said, well, I can't vote for Obama. He's and he used the N-word. 85-year-old white Democrat. Hmm. So, you know, some of these are stories. There's a lot of polling data, but I do think that generally speaking, he's not seen as racially among younger people as he is among the older mm-hmm. folks who have more experience, more baggage.
Yeah. The story may be apocryphal, but I heard it, so I'll repeat it.
Sure.
About a person, a kid in maybe the, you know, seventh or eighth grade, a teacher told the story, and upon learning that Obama was, you know, has an African father and a white mother from Kansas, the kid said, "Well, that must mean everybody will like him." That's really generational, because a previous generation would say that means nobody is going to be able to like him because we'll find reasons to disagree. So to whatever extent that so-called millennial generation, the generation of kids born after 1982, view the world through a very different racial lens, and Obama has tapped into that, I think.
Right. Yeah.
And I just say that I spent 2 weeks in Malaysia and Singapore for the State Department in February talking about the election then. And then you could talk about gender, race, and age. Even though some people had problems with Obama's policy on trade to an extent, the enthusiasm for the symbol of Obama was just staggering.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, the Bush administration is trying to tie the hands of his successor, be it Obama or McCain, on the issue of Iraq by two measures. One is this recent oil agreement with four U.S. companies and one British company. With the Maliki government, which I read this morning in the New York Times, the State Department acted as an intermediary, which is interesting in that the occupier is pushing the occupied to okay these agreements. The idea is, if we're on the ground, if Shell, ExxonMobil, et cetera, are doing these service contracts, the American military will have to protect them. The other thing the Bush administration is doing is, under the guise of this SOFA arrangement, trying to circumvent the treaty obligations of our Senate. It's not just going to be what court takes care of the infractions of our military or private contractors in country. They're asking for the U.S. to have military rights and air control without going to the Iraqi government to ask for it. So not only will we be obligated to protect the oil companies, but we'll have the legal right to do it. To what extent is this going to tie the hands of his predecessor? Has either one of the candidates made any comments about this?
Well, I don't know about a lot of comments being made about that, but certainly protecting American interests is going to be something that each presidential candidate will, you know, assert that they will do. And the question is, of the different, you know, oil-producing countries in the world, what are the different models that we can look at? And the U.S. doesn't necessarily, you know, with lots of boots on the ground, protect Saudi oil installations. So they're, you know, although obviously they're under, you know, our protection in some ways. So it there may be more flexibility in what the next president can do in terms of, you know, protecting, you know, these strategic interests than having to have a 50 or 100-year occupation.
Mm-hmm. You want to comment on that, Professor Loomis?
Yeah, I just think that the Bush administration, I do think, again, with this legacy notion, is pushing this. I also think that we can see that a new president has, regardless of how he might look to be tied, particularly with the Democratic Congress, we'll probably have a little more running room than we're afraid of. But I come back to the original premise of the caller, and I'm not much of a cynic in terms of reading this as just oil or predominantly oil, even largely oil, but it's hard not to make some judgments along those lines that oil remains a really substantial factor here. And as the price goes up, it becomes all the more important.
More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political, which you hear every Monday at 9 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Our guests are Professor Burdette Bird Loomis, professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Kansas, and Professor David Jackson, associate professor in the Department of Political Science, Bowling Green State University. We have one line open if you'd like to grab it. It's yours, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, and I meant to say this to you last week, some of your emails are just so long that I can't scroll down and read all of them. So if you could make them a little bit more concise, it would be helpful. Thanks. Two more calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the gentleman who wrote the cover story, Mark Jenkins, for this month's National Geographic, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? Seven of these magnificent creatures were murdered last July, and the reason why it happened is an intriguing story and a story that indicates just how much violence and unrest and grabbing for power and depletion of natural resources is taking place all over the world, but particularly in this particular national park, which is considered one of the most important in the whole world. It should be an interesting conversation. All right, back to phone calls for Professor Jackson. Professor Loomis, let's go to Peg from Antigo. Hi, Peg.
Hi. My concern in this election, in the primaries, as I've seen once again, the media, which the mainstream media owned by huge corporations, you know, have so much to gain from all of the funding, all the revenue they get from this election. And also, I think they set the tempo and they decide which candidates will be zeroed in on. And now what I see is everything is John McCain the Maverick, John McCain the Maverick, the straight talker, and he's not now. And Obama didn't wear a flag pin and all this trivial stuff. And then you have so many people getting their information from blogs. And I'm concerned that people at this crucial time are not even trying to get information from various sources.
Do you want to take that, Professor Jackson, first, please?
Sure. I'm not sure that I'd call all that's gotten from blogs information. but the idea that a candidate gets an image and that that image is difficult to change is certainly true. It sort of gets repeated, you know, for good or ill. You know, poor Dan Quayle was considered a not-so-bright guy, and then every piece of information that could be found was added to that snowball to keep that image going. John McCain has been masterful in terms of his media relations ever since 2000, at granting, you know, greater levels of access, talking off the cuff, being seen as a maverick, even though, you know, his voting record is not, you know, anything that one would consider even moderate or you know, even close to left of center. He has disagreed with his party on a number of issues, which then, because of the right-wing talk radio just, you know, savaging him, has, I think, only improved his image. So it's a pretty good situation in terms of media relations that McCain finds himself in, or has put himself in, let's say it that way.
Mm-hmm. Professor Lewis?
I think we're in an election in which both candidates have done pretty well with the media in one way or another. At the same time, I think the caller first asks us to disbelieve the mainstream media because of commercial concerns, and then asks us to worry about the bloggers. So where are we going to get our information? Honestly, I think that in some ways we're we have too much information. There's the 24/7 news site. There is no news cycle. Things pop up instantaneously. We tend to focus perhaps on trivial mistakes rather than larger issues. But in terms of getting information, if we want it, there's never been a better time to do that. And so, you know, I think we've always got these issues. It looks to me that there are real policy differences between John McCain and Barack Obama. And if we sort through this, I have a confident feeling that the electorate, well, it's going to worry about a lot of other things, age, gender, or age and race. In the end, there are huge policy differences. We're in a difficult time. And I think the electorate, by and large, can sort it out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Zach from Green Bay. Hi, Zach.
Good morning. I just really wanted to voice a minor disagreement with what one of your guests said earlier, and that is when you were talking about economic issues, saying that Senator McCain's strength would be that he varies significantly from the Bush administration. From my understanding of his declared platform, as far as tax policy goes, he has flip-flopped, and now he is very much in line with doing the same tax policy, that is massive cuts for the wealthiest Americans, for corporations, and further cuts in taxes for oil companies. And in the health care crisis area, which is also a great economic issue, he wants to give a $5,000 tax credit, which would be very much in line with the wishes of the Bush administration, and which would amount to a $5,000 taxpayer-funded benefit to the private insurance industry. So I guess my point is that Senator McCain can claim he is different from the Bush administration on economic policy, but my understanding is he's very much the same as the Bush administration on economic policy.
Okay, Zach, thanks for your call.
I don't think either of us said that he was the same, that he did not that he differed from the Bush administration on economic policy. I think that's part of my broader point, that there are real serious policy differences here, and part of the Obama campaign will be to demonstrate that while McCain does have some differences and has had, that in many ways on the key issues, he's very similar to the Bush administration.
Yeah, I think the point that was made, we might not have made it as clearly as we could. It's not that there's a great deal of policy differences, especially once McCain changed his position to supporting the, you know, permanency of the tax cuts, but the image difference, the life story difference, the biography difference, the ways in which he's perceived of as just being the complete opposite of President Bush in terms of personality and style and biography is something that definitely works for John McCain. At least that's the point I would make.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Scott from Green Bay next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I guess I wanted to quit, some of the, and hysteria is probably a bad word, but comparing Obama to Perot when it comes to support and voters. I mean, they were all true believers. And the thing that I've noticed when you try and have a dialogue with Obama supporters, and you point out some of his positions on policy, it doesn't matter to them. It doesn't matter what his position is. They're true believers. And that's the same thing I remember talking to people that were staunch Perot believers. When you talk to them about positions Perot had, it didn't matter to them. They were going to vote for him regardless of trying to have a dialogue with him. I mean, the more I listen to Obama, I listened to him a few years ago at a Sojourners conference, and he was fantastic, a great orator, great speaker, really seemed to be an innovator. But the more this campaign has gone on, the more he's just another Powell. I mean, he's just another Chicago Democrat that's running for president.
Well, I think a more apt comparison might be with Ronald Reagan, because the Democrats complain so bitterly that in survey after survey and issue after issue, people would disagree with Ronald Reagan, yet still vote for him. Now they may have actually nominated somebody who has some of the same communication skills and personal likability. It'll certainly get him better than the 19% of the vote Perot got.
Hmm.
And I also think that since we're starting to make comparisons to icons, I mean, I think you might go back to Franklin Roosevelt, who ran to the center, ran to get elected, and then adjusted accordingly in historic ways. I think that if we had the last 8 years of the Gore administration, we might think a little differently here. But we didn't. Al Gore lost, John Kerry lost very narrowly, and I think Barack Obama, in his own way, running a very good primary campaign, seems to be learning some of those lessons, and we'll only see how that experiment turns out in November.
Yeah, I think you said it earlier. I mean, you can count many times when Democrats have been happy to lose honorably. Well, you don't get to govern if you lose honorably, mm-hmm. And so is it cynical for Obama to want to win? I think that's would be a very unfair thing to say about any politician.
Mm-hmm. I think he's run a heck of a campaign. I mean, the whole strategy seems to have worked for him. Here's a guy who nobody knew. I still find it amazing that he's the Democratic nominee over Hillary Clinton. He obviously knew how to organize the country to get the votes.
I think Hillary Clinton finds it amazing.
Right, right.
As well.
Yeah.
Indeed. He ran an incredible campaign, took caucus state seriously, had a strategy for after Super Tuesday, could raise money, use the internet more effectively, just, on point after point after point,
mm-hmm.
Strategized and out-tactized, if that's a word. the greatest, Democratic political, operation.
Is it, we've been hearing a lot over the weekend, I have, that the states in the West could make the difference in the general election. If he wins everything that Kerry won in 2004 and picks up three states that could go Democratic, he's got it made.
Well, there's a lot of paths to the White House. There's a lot of paths to that 270 electoral votes. So if we write off Ohio, which I don't think he'll do, and as a resident of Ohio, I enjoy being a swing state, he could make up Ohio's electoral votes with, Colorado, Nevada, and New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to have different paths to the 270 electoral votes instead of believing that there's only one path and having to have every single state go the right way.
I think the idea of expanding the electoral map, you go back to the Dean candidacy and the Dean head of the Democratic National Committee, the idea that you could have 20, 25 states in play to one extent or another, I think it's just healthy for democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for being with us, and we still have some months ahead, so I hope you'll join us on some future programs.
I'd be pleased to be back anytime.
Great.
Kathleen, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you. Good guests. Our guest, Professor David Jackson, Associate Professor, Undergraduate Advisor, and he has a special interest, actually, in entertainment and politics. We'll have to talk to him about just that sometime, the influence of pop culture in young adult political socialization. He is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Bowling Green State University. Professor Burdette Bird Loomis, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Kansas, got his MA and PhD from University of Wisconsin-Madison and is teaching American politics, Congress, interest groups, and state legislatures. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing our All Things Political segment for this Monday, which we always do. And thanks to John Anderson for on-air production in our studios in our Milwaukee offices. Thanks to you for listening and calling in, too. We always get good calls on this show. News is coming up. We'll return with more Monday conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.